There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
The country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners, to the 45th podcast. I am back with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Sarah Basha. Hi, ladies.
Hi, guys.
Hey, good to be back.
It has once again been an eventful week, and I don't know about you guys, but every week I have a running list of, I got to talk about that. I mean, I literally, what I do during the week is I just like send tons of articles to myself so I can mark, like, these are the issues I want to talk about. And if I actually went through all that, I could alone talk for 3 hours. I don't, it's very, very hard to figure out like what to narrow it down to.
But then on Thursday before you record, everything changes. So you toss it all out and start again.
You toss it all out. But then by Friday, it's stale again, right? So,
well, for my day job, I get so much stuff thrown at me that I just cannot keep a track of what to send to myself and what not.
Sarah, what are you doing right now? So you recently switched jobs. Can you tell us what your day job is right now?
So I moved to a think tank. It's called the Center for Global Policy, and there are a great bunch of people. And what we do is use analysis-driven recommendations for foreign policy towards the Muslim world. So it's very interesting.
Oh, so it's all foreign policy oriented.
Yeah, and specifically to the Muslim world, which could include any country in the world, not just the Middle East or South Asia. So it's got three thematic areas. It deals with political Islam. It deals with countering violent extremism and also Muslims in the West.
Well, I'm sure after this trip to the Middle East, you guys have a lot of work on your hands and a lot of things to consider. And we're going to talk about a couple portions of that trip. But before we get to that, we're going to start off with this really terrible tragedy that happened in Manchester, England, which was a suicide attack at a Ariana Grande concert, like right towards the end of the concert. So I'm just going to turn it over to you, Sara, to talk us through what happened and then kind of the implications of that.
Whenever one of these happens, it really riles me up because here I am as a Muslim in the U.S. watching all this stuff happening. And, you know, I do use public transport. I do spend a lot of time downtown D.C. and in public spaces for work. And I've got four kids, so I'm around and about a lot. So I worry about our safety sometimes. And I don't believe in being scared or, you know, fanning the flames. But these kinds of attacks are really concerning to me. And this one was, I don't know, it just keeps coming. And I wanted to relate how the administration handles these things and how the U.S. responds to stuff like this and how we ourselves are prone to these attacks. But our allies have to deal with this stuff at a much larger level in Europe. So I just wanted to go through the Manchester attack, take a look at how our administration has responded along with the UK, and kind of decipher how, you know, what Donald Trump and his administration has to deal with in terms of what Tillerson refers to as the assimilation of immigrants. So a real quick review where we are right now with the attack is there have been 22 victims. The youngest is 8 years old and the oldest has been 51 years old. There are men under arrest between the ages of 18 and 38. The attacker's older brother, who's 24, are being held. The father and the younger brother, who's 20, are being held in Libya by the Special Deterrence Force in Tripoli. The attacker's family actually moved back to Libya from Manchester a while ago. And there's a worry in general about linked or copycat killers. Just looking really quickly at this attacker's profile, he was born in Manchester. He supposedly, and this is just a supposed thing because I know that some people return to their native countries with their families over the summer during non-school months. But he supposedly, during that time while school was out, went to fight the Gaddafi regime with his father at 16, at the age of 16. But that's something that's not been corroborated. He's known by his friends to be kind of a jokester. He's gullible, short-tempered, and not very intelligent. His sister said he was upset at the U.S. airstrike in the Middle East and Syria. And there are reports that he supposedly may have been trained in Syria between 2014 and 2015.
He would have been very young. He would have been, what, like 19, yeah. 20 years old at the time?
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, I'm going to get into this, but I think the fact that in 2016 there was a huge U.S.-led, attack on ISIS with the Libyan forces included might have triggered some of these responses. But he was supposedly planning this attack since the end of 2016, and he actually went back to Libya on April 19th of 2017, so just last month. And then he left again on May 17th. And it's been reported that his family took him back to Libya because he got into trouble with gangs when one of his friends was killed in the UK. So they took him back on the 17th and they confiscated his passport.
May 17th. You mean of this year?
Okay. In April of 2017, they took his passport, took him back to Libya. Then he lies to his parents and tells them he's going to Saudi Arabia for the pilgrimage and that he needed his passport back for that. So they give it back to him. And instead of going to Saudi Arabia, he arrives back in the UK through Germany on May 17th and, of course, puts into action his plan. So, I mean, the backdrop for where this person is coming from, you know, Libya fell, the Gaddafi regime fell in 2011. And since then, there have been many militias that have been popping up. And it's a very oil-rich country. But there's been no viable government in any area. So there's warring factions in many ways. And it's got a very porous border. And there's lots of arms floating around. So it's most of the hotspots for the militia activity have been in Benghazi and Derna and the southern areas. But ISIS was running rampant here. In 2016, the U.S. and Libyan forces actually captured Sirte, which was, you know, their biggest assault on ISIS. But it still remains, in the country, along with different governmental forces and militias. So it's chaos, basically, in Libya.
So let me ask you something. You're saying that we know the father was against Gaddafi. So he fought against Gaddafi, right? Are the allegations now his father is being also held and the other brothers are being held. But I don't understand that if the father was also part of the parental plan to take away his passport, like how did those things happen at the same time? That we're taking away your passport so you don't do anything crazy, but he also was complicit in the plan?
It looks like, and according to the sister and the siblings, they kind of knew he was up to something, but it looks like the parents weren't aware of it. So I think when he got involved in gangs and was, you know, kind of veering towards criminal activity down in Manchester in his home area, I think they noticed that he's getting a little out of control. So I'm not sure what the level of involvement of the parents is in terms of this particular attack. But I do have a theory that, you know, if you're going to have a dad who's involved in militia actions and stuff that's very warlike, of course you're going to tend to be violent yourself because you're going to emulate what's happening in your house, you know?
Yeah, and along with the family thinking something might be up, apparently, you know, he was on law enforcement's radar. He was not an unknown quantity. Apparently, the community in Manchester had reported him repeatedly, and he was banned from, like, the local mosque because people thought that, you know, that he was up to something, but I'm not quite sure right now how he fell through the cracks as somebody who, like, you know, five times had been referred to law enforcement.
There are many thousands of people on this, not watch list, but persons of concern. So I think I don't want to blame anyone for him falling through the cracks because there's no way to predict this kind of stuff sometimes. But there are many people on this list, which means there are many people that might be involved in stuff in the native countries that seem to be a little questionable. They were warned. They had looked into him. And I think the fact that he was involved in gang stuff locally, I'm not sure how that ties into it. But I think his parents noticed that he's getting a little out of control. And that might have been the impetus for them taking him back to Libya with them. So, you know, what I found interesting is how the UK and the US administration reacted to this. So, of course, the New York Times, you know, crossed a line in going ahead and releasing some pictures of the crime scene, which they weren't supposed to do. And that caused problems.
To back up, though, before even we got involved there, we had to do that because there was a sort of outpouring of leaks, like very, very early investigation, like hours into it.
Yeah.
And that's, in this case, a different kind of leaking than we've been seeing politically from the White House. Who was leaking this information and why? And a lot of fingers can be pointing at the administration itself as sort of a preemptive, let's point at the Muslims angle. Like, there's no other reason to leak this information than to try and get a narrative established early on about what had happened.
But I don't think it's necessarily the administration that was leaking anything. I think this the U.S. media.
President Trump actually apologized for the leak and said, this will not happen again. So there were leaks from the administration to the media about what was happening, and including releasing pictures and things like that.
Wait, so the question is, where did the New York Times get those pictures from? Those are not their independent pictures. Those are pictures that were given to them from the administration? I doubt that.
Yes, and the names who were involved very early on.
That's exactly what happened. Yep.
Okay. Well, in that case, Tillerman had to go and do some damage control, and he did. And when he did, I guess what was interesting to me was actually the type of language he used. It was more about addressing this as an immigration issue and how he wants to know how we can do better at assimilating people from other countries or immigrants, and what are we doing as a nation to assimilate them better in the U.S. This is where I find, and I'd like the listeners to take a listen to this piece, and it's about a 2-minute piece, but it's worth listening to the whole thing. It's an interesting interchange between Boris Johnson and Rex Tillerson on what they see is, you know, what the, not the reasons necessarily, but what needs to be done to address this issue.
Clearly, migration of people, movement of people, immigration of people, and crossing back and forth of borders is a significant challenge in how we confront acts of terrorism. And it is a challenge given our free society. I think the other element of it that I've heard the President express in exchanges with leaders throughout this trip is our inability to assimilate people, that for whatever reason, as people immigrate into our countries, whether it be in Great Britain or in the United States or other countries, we seem to have difficulty assimilating those people so that they feel part of our society and would never consider supporting acts of violence against their fellow citizens and their fellow neighbors. So I think that it's an extremely complex issue, this mass migration of people that we are witnessing around the world. It's not a problem only for Great Britain. It's not a problem only for the United States. It's a problem for countries all over the world. It's one that we have to learn better how to address.
Yeah. Well, Michael, I just think there are two elements to your question. I mean, the first is about mass migration and the role of NATO in helping to solve that. I certainly think NATO can have an important role in trying to address the big movements of people that we're seeing at the moment coming up from the southern Mediterranean area. Clearly, that's putting a lot of pressure on Europe, and it's something that the UK is in the lead in trying to help with. I certainly think NATO has a role there, and I think the President is right in that respect. I also think that one thing that the on the second aspect, the US and the UK are countries that in many ways are built on immigration. And America is a fantastic country and economy that has thrived and prospered by the Statue of Liberty holding out its beacon to the world. And that's been an inspiring message for generations. And in our own country, we've had very successful integration over many decades, and we can achieve that. You may not know, my great-grandfather was a Muslim, and he came to this country. Indeed, he came to Wimbledon in the early part of the last century. And, you know, there you go. I went on to become the mayor of London and indeed foreign secretary. So integration is possible. It's what we should aspire to. It's what we can achieve. And I think if you look at the American Commonwealth, you look at what's been achieved there, you look at the success of London, I think that's what we should be aiming for.
Totally true story. I had a friend visiting me the other week, and I had a bunch of boxes by the front door, packages that had arrived but I hadn't opened yet. And she saw the one on top and got really excited because it was from Third Love. She's a huge fan of their products, and it wasn't until I tried on the bra that I got from Third Love that I understood why she was so excited. And let me tell you why you should be too, because ladies, you can stop tugging at your bra straps and second-guessing your size. It is time to put fit first with Third Love. Third Love uses women's real measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and are more comfortable, and I promise you, they're going to be one of the most comfortable bras you've ever worn. Gorgeous material. They offer sizes from AA to G, as well as their exclusive half cup sizes. You just have to answer a few simple questions online, and Third Love will recommend a bra in the right size and style for you. And right now, Third Love is offering you a chance to try one of their perfect 24/7 bras free for just 30 days. All you do is pay $2.99 for shipping, and you are on your way to a perfect fit. You'll get to really live in this bra. Feel free to wash it, wear it all day. You might even forget that you're wearing it. If Third Love isn't your favorite new bra, you can just return it or exchange it for free. Go to thirdlove.com/45th now to get your perfect Third Love bra and try it for 30 days. That's thirdlove.com/45th to try your new bra for free. thirdlove.com/45th. If Tillerson's slant on this is, you know, how do we create better environments for immigrant assimilation or integration, or however you want to think about it, although there will be people who argue that, you know what, that's obnoxious too, and immigrants and anybody is free to not assimilate and integrate with society as long as they're peaceful citizens. But, you know, that is kind of a sea change, because my expectation from this administration would be that this would be the kind of event that would trigger more anti-immigrant sentiment. Like, you know, like, yeah. this is why we want the Muslim ban. This is why we want, you know, extreme vetting. This is why we, I mean, like, so many times these events, like when they take place, the fear in immigrant communities is like, this is not going to be used to really clamp down on us.
You know what I think, Rabia? I think that that's what I would have expected to hear from him if it had been any other government he was dealing with in addressing this. But I happen to think the UK, even though I have an issue with how Jeremy Corbyn was trying to say that, you know, this is all related to conflict in other countries, that's a little naive in its approach. But I do want to say the Brits are a lot more nuanced and a lot more calm and methodical, and they're not as open in their release of information because they deal with these things in a different way. And I think part of Tillerson's approach to this has been a little bit of the UK rubbing off on them in terms of calm down, let's look at what's happening here, and let's approach this in a more, you know, sort of like a, I think, less sensationalist way, which is how the U.S. tends to deal with things, because it turns into a media circus very quickly. So I think listening to this piece, you will see that the two of them are trying to complement each other's comments.
So what, calm down and Brexit?
No. No, it was more like, you know what Boris actually brings up? He actually brings up NATO and how it's faced with an issue of immigration from the southern Mediterranean areas. And so I think they're looking at this as an immigration issue. But I have to say that, you know, how come we go and we let people into the into our countries that are going back to fight in hot conflict zones in their native countries, and we don't monitor what they're doing? I mean,
we do monitor that. Definitely get monitored.
Exactly. So it really surprises me that this kid's father and siblings are all going out and doing these things, and yet they're on the radar in the UK, but yet nothing happens beyond that. I don't know. I think this leads into my next thing, is the many problems that I have with the way Muslims in the U.S. handle some of this stuff, and what the administration has to recognize about the communities over here as well.
Sarah, before you get into that, can I just make one point? I think it's important for folks to understand that the U.S. and many countries in Europe have very different policies about people who do end up going overseas to fight. In the United States, even if you don't make it past the airport, you are going to go to prison forever, okay? I mean, like, if they catch you, you're going, that's it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whereas in numerous countries in Europe, they now have established even policies that allow people who have gone to fight to actually return back and reintegrate. And so there is a slightly different approach. I think it's for a couple different reasons. And one of those is that because they don't consider these people necessarily threats to their own homeland. They know that they have gone overseas to fight in whatever conflict they think is some kind of an important cause. And I think the second thing is that there are much higher percentages of Muslim populations. The Muslim population in the United States is very, very small. You can't approach it in the same way. So, but United States, this stuff is monitored. People are, if you go over, you are not coming back. If you try to come back, you're going to be arrested. There's no reintegration,
Well, this also goes back to one of the conversations we had in an episode gone past is, the issues of transnational crime and how some of these European countries are maybe not equipped or not doing what's necessary to monitor this, because some of the attacks that have happened in Belgium, for instance, and I've mentioned this one before, is criminal activity, plain and simple. Now, whether or not these guys, before going out in a blaze of fire, kind of say, I did it for ISIS, there's lone wolves out there who will kind of tag ISIS in it or just...
Right.
So, it's very complicated, but I do question that. I'm not saying that the UK, it's the UK's fault that this happened, but I'm just saying there has to be something that they need to be looking at in terms of tracking where these people are going back to their native countries where there's huge ISIS presence at a time like this. But I have to say that I do get sick of Muslims who don't claim this is a problem within their societies and truly address it and constantly separate themselves or minimize it or act like they're victims of religious discrimination when people point that there isn't a religious element to it. So they sometimes don't even recognize that there's a problem.
I would push back there because there absolutely is a racist, reactionary, anti-Muslim reaction.
Not denying that.
So it's not, but I don't see how calling people out for reacting to a genuine sort of hatred directed towards them.
No, what I'm saying is people conflate being stared at weirdly on a bus because of a hijab with problems happening in other parts of the world. I mean, they're connected in some ways, but you cannot ignore the fact that there's a larger problem out there and just spend your time whining about people singling you out because of the way you look or something you went through. I mean, you have to also address the other problem, which is to say there are a bunch of crazy renegade people using our religion in twisted political ways to get what they want, and we need to weed them out ourselves. We need to address that fact. You cannot constantly just say,
why should you guys have to be like responsible for that? Because you're also Muslim.
I'm just going to listen.
Well, I'm not saying American Muslims have to go out and do it, but I'm saying Muslims themselves throughout the world have to take ownership of this issue and solve it at a local level themselves, because we can't impose things constantly from the outside. How do we even know how to do that, right?
But why is it a Muslim thing? It's very much a national sort of issue.
And that's the problem. The liberals keep going, it's not a Muslim thing. It's nothing to do with Islam. Well, let's face it. These guys are using those texts. They are using the religion within their political goals. And we need to, I don't know how we can prevent it from happening. It's got to be a multi-pronged approach. It can't just be online or just military. It has to be really holistic, and it has to be...
But Sarah, let me ask you this. In this specific instance, and this has happened in other instances too, the Muslim community did call... they reported him to law enforcement repeatedly. What else could the Muslim community do? I am somewhere between both of you, and I think it's both of your responses plus many other issues that complicate this thing, which is not knowing how to respond, when to respond, what's going to stop it. We've tried. We have military intervention. We have online interventions. We have community interventions. We are throwing everything we can at this issue. We have religious leadership that has spoken out like every single time this happens. I know what you're talking about, where you have a handful of community activists who say, this is not our problem, not our issue. And I understand where they're coming from. But when it comes to religious leadership, you and I know every national, international Muslim religious leader has repeatedly condemned terrorism. And so now, and in this instance, you have the community itself, which is reporting this guy. So now my concern with this is, I don't know if there's a right answer. I don't know if we're ever going to figure out this answer. It's almost like saying, how do you prevent any crime from ever happening? I don't think it's possible. But
yeah, it's not going to happen.
Right. So my question is what do you expect? What do we expect of this administration? This is kind of my bigger concern now, because we have we put in a lot of resources on these issues prior administrations, and it's going to look different now.
Perfect question. And that's my thing. If you're going to go to the Middle East, make arms deals, which, would have happened in a perfectly normal administration too, which is fine. The question is, where is this?
I love that you use normal administration.
Well, you know where I stand on that one. Right. But there's a newer generation of American Muslims who are more activist-like in the U.S. that haven't lived in these parts of the world to see that there is this issue. So I grew up in Kuwait. I saw that there was a bit of the underlying Shia-Sunni thing happening. It was very real. And I frankly don't want that garbage over here. I don't believe in it. I live very wonderfully here with my Shia friends. I love them like my own family. So I don't get that stuff. And it's all political.
No, but like demographically, it's not Islam. Like, if we want to solve this problem with demographics,
right. True. Exactly.
We ban all socially isolated young 20-something males.
Right.
Poof, problem right. solved.
Yeah.
You know what really bothers me, Susan? Have you heard this before coming from the Muslim community? There is more gun violence in America than there are terrorist attacks. So, you know, let's put this in perspective. I'm like,
oh, I'm not bothered by that. I'm like, that's no, absolutely true.
No, you that's know true, what? Though.
But listen. But let me finish. This is why it annoys me. Stop comparing apples and oranges. We're talking about the fact that terrorism could spread, could become really widespread, and you're comparing it to something completely different in order to, say, minimize it? I mean, for God's sake, they're two different things. Gun violence is an indigenous U.S. problem. I'm not saying it's not a bad problem, and I'm not saying we don't have to solve it, but don't compare it to something else and say, well, it's not as important as this. It's like deflecting from the importance
of this. But why is it not? It kills thousands more. Right. Why is it less important? It actually kills far, far more people in the
U.S. I get that. But that minimizes the other issue by comparing apples and oranges. They're not the same thing. This is a foreign ideology.
The comparison is not that these things are like this. The comparison is only made, I think, in terms of the attention and resources we mm-hmm. throw at them and the hypocrisy of politicians when addressing both these things, right? So listen, politicians will throw all kinds of money at, like, you know, countering violent extremism, you know, countering terrorism, millions and millions, if not billions of dollars, but keep in place laws that allow anybody who, all kinds of people, people with mental health issues, people who are like disillusioned, people just angry and racist and ugly, criminals, to get guns very easily.
Okay.
The comparison is our response to it.
If you want to talk about gun violence, talk about drugs too. Talk about everything in the U.S., right? This is a foreign ideology, and it's a totally different ballgame. It's a different issue. So why do some American Muslim scholars bring that up and go, well, there's more? I'm like, okay, but that doesn't have any relevance to the fact that this is a growing problem and a threat, okay?
So question, Sarah, or in Rabia. Have you guys heard of Damon Smith?
No.
Who is he?
He was someone who had a plot to bomb the tube and put a bomb together. And if it succeeded, it would have killed lots and lots of people.
Where?
But in England.
Okay.
She said tube. That means England.
Okay.
But no one talks about it. Why? Because it's a white dude who did it.
Right.
Like, same pattern. Isolated young choice-ling male who did something really terrible. Of course, he can like raise the, I was just joking. Or like, I didn't know what I was doing defense because he's a white boy. But it's not...
It's equally a threat, comparison.
And it gets zero attention because it's not a Muslim.
So yeah, but listen.
When we downplay real threats because it's not a Muslim thing, that's also harmful.
Those are constant. Those kinds of threats are being thwarted every single day. They're not all reported, but this one actually went through. This one in Manchester went through, which is why we're talking about it, because 22 people died. It's like the biggest attack they've ever had.
Yeah, so of course you should talk about it. At the same time, when the guy was driving down Times Square, everyone really cared a lot. Until it came out, he was just a drunk with a DUI, and like, oh, no big deal. Same exact event, same exact damage. And yet we only respond when we see it as like a Muslim threat, which I think is counterproductive because, again, the gun culture, way more deaths. Like someone like the Sandy Hook shooter, same exact pattern, and only it's way easier for him to get a gun because we make them available to everyone.
Yeah, you know, what people might not realize is when it comes to terrorism, the way people are charged and the way these things are understood is what was the motivating issue. Like two people can commit the exact same type of violence and one will be called an act of terror and the other one is, and these things are very much tied to politics and they're tied to foreign events, but it's called terrorism when it is ideologically religiously motivated and it's not called terrorism when it's like a hate crime, which is like, you know, like Dylann Roof. And you know, you can make the argument that that is also terrorism, but...
If I could smack the next scholar that walks into a room and is talking about countering violent extremism and bring up gun violence in America, I just want to smack him because I'm like, that's not what we're gathered in this room to talk about. So don't deflect. I get it. We're not doing a sliding scale of what's the most, you know, detrimental or most lethal thing in the U.S. right now. We're talking about a specific thing. So don't use that argument on me.
So, Sarah... when we focus a lot of resources on a problem like this, I think that's counterproductive in that a death doesn't matter more simply because it was caused by terrorism. And we focus on a very small, tiny amount of death, like a very, very, very small number of deaths, and give it the huge disproportionate attention we're giving. That's the only way these terrorists can get what they want. Like, literally, these attacks can't do anything to a nation. They cannot cause enough damage to actually harm its infrastructure. They cannot actually take the West down what they're doing. Only way they can possibly achieve anything is by making everyone so upset they vote for Trump.
Yeah, but listen, you can also partially blame the media for constantly running the same silly stories 24/7 just to make everybody feel wired about it. It's not necessarily that it's our government can't focus on the fact that it's just a little piece of the issue here. I mean, they're putting into perspective doesn't mean the media knows how to do that. So, but you know, the other thing is there's a link between distorted religious motivations and the politics of the Middle East. And I'm tired of people not realizing that this is a Mideast problem and that it has spread its propaganda worldwide. And so it's sometimes a South Asian problem too.
Let me just stop you 1 second. I'm not disagreeing with you that the politics of the Middle East, that the, you know, decades of like oppression in the Middle East have absolutely directly contributed to this. But, you know, earlier you said, you know, what the U.S. is contributing by, you know, in different ways, and we have to think about how we're contributing. Well, one thing you haven't mentioned is our military aggression. You know, like when you find these are people, either many times these are people who like Somalian youth in Minneapolis, United States. These are people who are tied to conflict regions, right? Either their families came from them, they grew up in them, they're refugees from them, or they feel some kind of empathy from a distance, but they feel some, you know, for some reason connected. But these are almost all regions in which we have bombed the crap out of them. Okay, so you're talking about like decades of violence that have been engaged in. And what, you know, I've worked with the Carter Center on a number of different things, and that's, you know, one thing that, you know, like from their perspective and the perspective of many people who work in the realm of, and you know this, conflict resolution, peace building, we have to model this. We have to stop. Like, we cannot expect to be violent as a state and not get a violent response from its citizens.
No, listen, Robbie, I agree with you, okay? We bombed 200 Syrian civilians in our latest attempt to help out. And yes, we did that. And then we did countless things in Iraq, right? But at the same time, we are helping Libyan forces push back ISIS. We are doing other operations. And I know it's not enough. I know it's schizophrenic. But at the same time, why the heck aren't these countries taking care of their own issues so we don't even have to do that? That's my thing. When are we going to take ownership? When are we going to grow up, put on our big boy pants, and just take ownership of our issues and understand that we have to control our countries?
Like, no, Sarah, look, you bring up the issue of, you know, well, first of all, we have to recognize that when Trump was in Saudi just last week, this is one thing that he's attempting apparently to do is to help create this new
empower.
Right. This new coalition of Arab power. Right. But I really wonder if that's something that we really want. Yeah. And when I say we, I mean, you know, like the U.S. foreign policy structure. I mean, like, this has never been, it's never been considered in our foreign interest. It's never been considered in our national interest to allow that to happen.
Forget what the U.S. wants. It's what they want. At this point, they should be doing what they want.
I feel like you have something to say, Susan.
yeah, no, that's not where I'm going to. I think that this is where the long term, I think this is where we need to have Dukakis in charge to take a more procedural approach to things and say, you know what? Let's get you on the road to functioning democracyhood and take it that way. It's the long term approach. It's not an instant fix, but in the end, it's the only way to fix it.
Okay. Well, also, you guys, I have to say that the assimilation part that Tillerson talks about, let's do this, okay? Let Muslims across the world realize they have to do their part and stop asking other peoples to either help them or make the conditions good for them to function. A lot of immigrants come here and they live in their little bubbles, their little cultural bubbles, and I know it takes time to assimilate, but they are so guarded about wanting to do things the way they did back home and trying to serve their native countries. I mean, for God's sake, you moved here. This is your country. Now, all right, live with it, and if you don't like it, you can go back. True, but at the same time, the assimilation is not just the onus.
I'm just going to annoy you here, Sarah, and say this: if I really wanted to assimilate as an American, one of the American values is it is this gun culture. I would be out there with the NRA.
No,
I'd be like, yes, I would. I would be like, Bible and gun, give it to me. We'd have a lot of brown people
with
guns.
That's not American culture. You just it's dumbing it down. But that's American culture. You're dumbing down. But listen, that's not the type of assimilation we're talking about. We're talking about truly going out there, voting, getting into your communities, mixing with people, not looking at everybody like they're different from you. Just, you know, truly thinking of yourself as an American and not just, you know, as somebody that's just been transplanted here and just has to live with it.
I think this goes brilliantly into the conversation, Susan, you want to have, which is the election of a new U.S. representative through a special election. And this representative violently assaulted a journalist the night before he was elected. So, yeah, I do wonder how much violence is a part of our culture and is not. So, Susan, I'll turn it over to you now.
So, yeah, the Montana special election was Thursday. And on Wednesday, about 5 o'clock, Ben Jacobs with The Guardian tweeted about how Greg Gianforte had just body slammed him and broken his glasses. And I think everyone thought it was a joke at first. And then someone was like, actually, no, Ben just texted me. It's really just happened. And what we know now is that Jacobs went in to talk to Gianforte at an event. There was another news crew there, a local news crew that was set up in the room as well. And when Jacobs asked Gianforte about his thoughts on the CBO score for the AHCA, out of nowhere, really with like no... It just goes from 0 to 60. Gianforte grabs him about the throat, like on the shoulders, throws him to the ground, gets on top of him, repeatedly punches him until finally Jacobs can like scramble away and protect himself. And Gianforte just yells at him, get out. So luckily, because Jacobs is a ninja and totally on the ball, he kept wits about him. He had a recorder, kept it going, and was able to like coherently state what had happened after the fact. And here's the audio that he got that day.
As you know, you were waiting to make your decision about healthcare until you saw the bill and it just came out. And what you thought?
We'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah, but there's not going to be time. I'm just curious if you have the
action. Speak with Shane, please.
But you don't.
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last time you came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here.
Jesus.
Get the hell out of here. The last guy did the same thing. You were the guardian?
Yes, and you just broke my glasses.
The last guy did the same damn thing.
You just body slammed me and broke my glasses.
Get the hell out of here.
You'd like me to get the hell out of here, I'd also like to call the police. Can I get you guys' names?
Hey, you gotta leave.
He just body slammed me.
You gotta leave.
So in a lot of cases, even when if you're witnessing it, the assault is like extremely unambiguous, straightforward, it's very clear what happened. The audio of such encounters can often be extremely ambiguous or hard to interpret. This one's not. This one's really straightforward and really obvious of what happened here. And that there is no sort of provocation on Jacob's part until Gianforte just snapped. He was even asked him about like the CBO score on a new bill, which, by the way, Gianforte has still not answered what he feels about the AHCA. So, you know, rather than answer the question, he assaulted the reporter and got away with it.
Oh, wait. So at this point, a Fox News reporter said that, see, there's conflicting things. Somebody said that
there's no confliction. That's a Laura Ingraham lie being passed around.
No, but somebody said that he held on to, apparently he had touched him or twisted his wrist or something.
That was a lie. That was a total lie.
Who had actually said that? Yeah, where did
that come from? That was Gianforte's campaign. So Gianforte's campaign, and this is after the audio is released. So like a couple hours later, The Guardian puts up the audio of the assault. It's very clear what happened. Then Gianforte's campaign releases a statement that says, tonight, as Greg was giving a separate interview in a private office, The Guardian's Ben Jacobs entered the office without permission, aggressively shoved a recorder in Greg's face, and began asking badgering questions. Jacobs was asked to leave. After asking Jacobs to lower the recorder, Jacobs declined. Greg then attempted to grab the phone that was pushed in his face. Jacobs grabbed Greg's wrist and spun away from Greg, pushing them both to the ground. It's unfortunate that this aggressive behavior from a liberal journalist created the scene at our campaign volunteer barbecue. This whole statement is a lie, by the way. As Jacobs put it, they got his name and his employment right, but that's it. It's a blatant lie that uses like buzzwords like liberal journalists justify a random assault on another person. There were three Fox News journalists in the room who all backed up Jacobs' account and actually said that like Jacobs was downplaying it because Jacobs at the time, I mean, probably in shock, had just said he got body slammed. What the Fox News reporter saw is that not only did Gianforte grab him by the throat and throw him to the ground, he got on top of him and started punching him.
Whoa, I didn't hear the punching part. Wow.
Yeah, that was the Fox News team.
Was there like some kind of personal beef between these guys from beforehand, or was it just completely random?
To me, it sounds like it was more this guy has contempt for journalists and anger issues, but also this guy did break a story about his heavy investment in Russian companies. So it's possible he knew him in particular.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know what, this happened. And my very first thought was like, we're going to see if we still live in a society where power is not allowed to use force to get their way. And I was hoping I was wrong. I wasn't wrong. We are in a horrifying place as a nation. And it's one of those things where it made me just sort of think, I don't know if we can be saved anymore. And I'm not sure we deserve it if we can't be. Because how do you come back from this? How do you come back from having someone physically assault a reporter with no aggression? As the Fox News team confirmed, there was no aggression from Jacobs, nothing whatsoever. Out of the blue, this guy didn't want to answer a question, so he assaulted the reporter, threw him to the ground, attacked him. Then
but what do you mean?
It.
How do you come back? He actually won.
How do we come back to be a place where this is not okay?
Yeah, I know.
You know what? So, Sarah, what would it take for...
I agree with you on this one. It's ridiculous.
The Republicans are still supporting him, though. Like,
well, Ryan was like, say sorry. I'm like, you know what? It goes deeper than saying sorry, I think.
It's not like... They're like, oh, that's really awkward. They don't care about what happened. And in the 24 hours after the attack, Gianforte raised $100,000.
Wow.
We as the public, like, what would it take for Republicans to have disavowed Gianforte? Like, if he'd broken an arm, probably not. Broken a leg, like, if he'd killed the guy, sure. But at this point,
I don't even know. I mean, to me, it seems, and I think this is true also with Trump. I mean, no matter what he does, GOP leadership, until and unless they feel like they are going to lose their seats, they're just going to stay quiet. They're not going to oppose any of this. And I think in this particular race, you know, he was slated to win anyways, right? This is a red, This is a red seat.
A super red seat. Trump won by 20 points.
Right. So, you know, they're not going to they're not going to go against their voters, their base. And it comes down to self-preservation, which I think is really sad.
And here's what the GOP has had to say about this. Representative and NRCC chairman Steve Stivers. From what I know of Greg Gianforte, this was totally out of character, but we all make mistakes. We need to let the facts surrounding this incident unfold. Today's special election is bigger than any one person. It's about the views of all Montanans. They deserve to have their voices heard in Washington. And here's what Paul Ryan had to say.
There is no time where a physical altercation should occur with the press or with just between human beings. So that is wrong and it should not have happened. Should the gentleman apologize? Yeah, I think he should apologize. I know he has his own version and I'm sure he's going to have more to say, but there's no call for this, no matter what, under any circumstance. The people of the state of Montana are going to decide today who they will send to Congress.
If he wins, will you see him?
If he wins, he has been chosen by the people of Montana, who their Congress is going to be. I'm going to let the people of Montana decide who they want as their representative. That's not our choice. That's the people of Montana who choose that.
You have the choice whether he's a part of your conference. That is a choice that you guys are going to make to accept him or not. Is this the kind of behavior?
The choice will be made by the people of Montana. I do not think this is acceptable behavior, but the choice will be made by the people of Montana.
Here's what Senator Daines had to say. I have confidence in local law enforcement. I do know Greg Gianforte has been charged with misdemeanor assault, and we'll leave the questions and answer to local law enforcement. I don't condone violence in any way.
Speaking of which, by the way, Susan, I thought a misdemeanor assault was kind of like not the right charge here.
What would you say, Rabia, should...
Look, I don't know what the state law is there, but and I've never practiced criminal defense, or criminal law, but isn't a misdemeanor when somebody... It is kind of like a it's something that's done by mistake, or it's something that's very, very like...
They could have charged. They could have had a harsher charge here.
Like assault and battery, like something harsher than this. I mean, this is a misdemeanor assault is usually something that's just, you know, somebody
shoving. Yeah.
Right. Something mistakenly. Or right. It's very kind of low violence.
Well, here's what California Representative Duncan Hunter had to say. It's not appropriate behavior unless the reporter deserved it. Here's Representative Leonard Lance.
I believe that we should all treat the press with respect, and I try to lead by example. I, of course, hope that the Republican is successful today because I think that his views are the views of the people of Montana.
And here's Representative Luke Messer. He said he wasn't sure whether the incident would help or hurt Gianforte in Thursday's special election. You know, like, maybe it'll help him. So Representative Charlie Dent, he said that conversations should always be civil and he needs more facts. But that if Gianforte wins, they'll welcome him into the GOP conference. Representative Trent Franks took the route of blaming liberals.
The left has precipitated this tense, confrontational approach throughout the country in recent months. I reject any kind of thing where we use physical violence in a situation like that. It should not have happened, and the law will have to be the ultimate arbiter.
Senator Jeff Flake said, "I don't think there's ever any excuse to throw down a reporter, so I'm not exactly sure what happened. As much as we've all thought about it from time to time, I don't think we'll go there." Really? You think about this all the time, or time to time? Okay, Representative Louis Gemmert.
You know, we didn't have a course on body slamming when I went to school. I missed that course. I'm sorry I missed it.
Yeah, because it's a joke, apparently. And then, of course, we have Trump and Pence. Trump and Pence, by the way, on the day before the election, ran robocalls supporting Gianforte, endorsing him. Like he's great. You're going to love him. After the assault, they were asked about it. The White House had no comment. And Pence would not even respond to a question, although he tweeted out his congratulations to Gianforte.
Well, Trump in the past and during his campaign, I mean, pretty much was like, you know, I think he opened the doors to assaulting the press.
Yeah. The Republicans right now embrace violence against reporters. Full stop. That's why he raised $100,000. Now, there were a couple, and I used the couple word literally, two reactions I could find from the GOP that were not either joking or brushing off or saying, stuff happens. One was Senator Ben Sasse, who made a tweet that said, "A big part of a public servant's job is teaching civics. If the First Amendment means anything, it means you can't body slam a journalist." Okay, good job for standing up for, like, not randomly assaulting people, but you need to go a bit farther than that.
Yeah.
And the only one who even, like, came out even in any kind of strong terms was Sanford, which, you know, I guess dude's been there, done that. He was asked about it, and here's his statement. "There is total weirdness out there. And, like I said, he's unearthed some demons. And people feel like if the President of the United States can say anything to anybody at any time, then I guess I can too. And that is a very, very dangerous phenomenon." And then if you're in a big convention center and you're yelling, "I wish I could hit you in the face," which the president said, and also, "And if not, I'll pay your legal bills." Words matter. I think it's more general than it is specific to the press, but the press is one of the boogeymen out there. There's a reason the Founding Fathers put the First Amendment as the first one we all need to think about.
It's so sad we have to go through this. I mean, this is so
we don't
crazy.
Have to. We don't have to go through it. The Republicans should say, Gianforte, you insulted someone. You have to stand down. They didn't. They are fully embracing the use of violence to carry out a political agenda.
I can't believe it's gotten to this.
That's not hyperbole. Yeah, we're in a terrifying place right now. Like, what kind of violence will they not excuse? This is not.
Well, you know what? Look, there's a complete lack of leadership on the part of the GOP by them not, like, modeling the kind of behavior that they find appropriate and inappropriate. And I know most of these folks, most GOP leadership would never be violent towards journalists. They would not, they themselves would never repeat this kind of rhetoric that, you know, that's come out of the Trump campaign, demonizing the press. Like, they've never done that before. But on the other hand, they're staying quiet because of voters. And so I'm like, what is happening to us? What is happening in a society that we are now, you know, like, raised $100,000 overnight for this guy, and he wins, you know, by a nice healthy margin, put in power a president who, you know, is obnoxious and would be violent if I didn't think he was such a coward. I think Trump is a total coward. I think he would actually walk away from a fight if he was confronted. But he encourages violence on his behalf, I think.
Yeah, Sarah, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I keep thinking, my brain keeps going back to the recent attack on peaceful protesters outside of the Turkish ambassador's house in the U.S. And I'm thinking, what example, like, what are we in that same bucket now? Do we do stuff like that? And it's very embarrassing to me.
It's scary. It's moving so fast. Like, today, do you think a year ago, if we'd said that a candidate that was going to get elected for office could randomly just body slam a reporter by the throat and punch him, and people would shrug their shoulders? And what I think it is I think the GOP, at least, is the fact they've sold their soul to an amoral idiot. And they can't, well, what grounds do they possibly have to draw a stand at assaulting a reporter? They endorsed a guy who bragged about sexual assault. They endorsed a guy who said, you can do it if you're powerful. They can't take a stand anymore. They've lost their soul. Like, where could they possibly credibly draw a line at this point?
Well, I can't say anything on that, just because I'm not sure that Republicans throughout the country are all on the same page as the GOP itself. I think there's very many of us that just are as shocked as to what's going on as Democrats, you know, we're just like, this is not the norm in any situation. And again, the GOP's been doing a lot of institutional and party-related stuff that I'm not sure is the umbrella kind of belief system of all Republicans. And I'm sad to say that, but maybe that's been happening for a while now. But maybe that's a generational thing. I have no idea.
I think there needs to be a new party. Like, it's just the current, like, conservatives aren't behind what's happening. But the GOP is so toxic and so... I mean, they're endorsing political violence at this point. And that is the actual, like, a neutral description of our reality that we're living in. And I don't know how they can continue to be one party.
Well, they wouldn't have if Trump hadn't won, right? And so if they had a different candidate and their base showed that, you know what, we do not stand for the values represented by Trump, then they would also be singing a different tune. And I'm kind of fascinated by this. I mean, throughout, you know, the primary election, Trump, again and again, trumping other candidates, and then now this with this guy, and you know, there's you know, this actually goes back to kind of like what you were saying, Sarah, about the attacks outside the Turkish embassy in Washington D.C. that happened from, you know, Turkish bodyguards, and like, you know, Erdogan was watching and apparently even directed them and said, you know, go get rid of these, and the administration said nothing. You know, this kind of draw towards strongmen and authoritarianism, I think we're seeing that in the United States. I think we are starting to, this is like this rise of illiberal democracy. It just seems more prevalent that people are embracing kind of like the kinds of leaders that much of the Muslim world has had to endure for decades. Yeah. And that does not end well. It doesn't end well for civil liberties, for human rights, for those on the margins of society in many ways.
Well, this crassness exists in all political, you know, situations throughout the world, but we just never let this stuff come up like this. It just wasn't acceptable. It wasn't accepted. It wasn't brushed aside. It wasn't minimized. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't done, I don't think.
Sarah, we need you to say this whole the GOP.
Yeah. You got to start a new party and like, yeah.
See, that's the thing. It's like a terrorist act happens. It's like, you're a Muslim. What do you say? I'm like, okay. And then a GOP member does something. You're a Republican.
Yeah,
what
but
do
you
say?
Chose one of, like, you choose to be part of the party.
I choose the principles that it was founded on, not this garbage that it's become. That's
fair
my. That's why
fair
I'm
enough.
On this show. Hello.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But you gotta fight for it. You gotta fight for its soul, just like as Muslims, we gotta fight for our faith. You're gonna make that argument. And you're gonna make the same argument.
Oh my God! It's a daily jihad.
Daily jihad.
Moving on.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about, and you know, actually, I'm really disappointed, Susan. I was really hoping to hear from you more on Russia this week, but I'm hoping you'll come back to that.
Don't worry, Russia's going nowhere.
Russia's going nowhere, and the investigation's deepening. So we will circle back to that later, and I love to hear your analysis on it specifically. But I want to talk, we didn't talk yet about Trump's little jaunt overseas. Last week, Sarah had talked about like what she kind of expected to happen in Saudi, why she thought it was, you know, probably an important visit for numerous reasons. You know, the oil issue, the economy in the Gulf states, which is actually suffering, which, you know, many of us are surprised to hear. And also alliances based around, like, you know, countering terrorism and things of that sort, national security issues, and then the creation of this new coalition of Arab states. So, you know, we all kind of, I mean, I watched Trump's speech in Saudi, and a friend of mine who was on CNN, you know, I think said very aptly, he said it was the kind of speech that a Saudi PR firm could have written themselves, because it was very, very, it was very conciliatory towards Saudi. There's no lecturing to Saudi. There was certainly no mention of human or civil rights, women's issues, nothing of that sort. What did you think of the speech, Susan?
He's not going to lecture the Saudis, but he's going to lecture our allies in Europe.
Which is what happened. That is true. That happened at the NATO meeting, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Well, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time in Saudi because, you know, not a lot happened there. Kushner made the arms deal before they even left. They all put their hands on this weird glowing orb.
Oh, God.
That was the creepiest thing. And, you know, there's a picture in which, like, you see, like, the people, like, King Salman and Trump and a few people in the front with their hands on the orb. But there's another picture that shows, like, the entire group of men behind them. And it's, like, hundreds of men just fanning out all, like, basically oriented physically towards the orb, and that is a much freakier picture. So if you can find that online, take a look at that. But I want to talk a little bit about the trips after that, which is Israel, Vatican, and NATO, because we didn't really talk about that last week. So let's start with Israel. The thing about Israel is this. So according to most reports, and you know, I specifically cite a BuzzFeed report, Trump is widely loved in Israel. And much of that is because the media coverage of Trump has been fairly positive, but also because the leadership in Israel is also quite open to Trump. And what's one of the interesting things, and this is something I mentioned before a number of episodes ago, is that when Israelis were asked about, well, you know, what about like Trump's rhetoric, which has allowed the rise of anti-Semitism and hate crimes in this country, they actually kind of don't believe it. They don't believe that that's actually happening. They think that's like a liberal media lie. And I had mentioned before that I have a friend who is a prominent Israeli journalist who just in my face said, nah, it's not true. There's no danger to Jews in America. It's just political. I was kind of surprised. So there's also the sense that Trump likes Israel, like kind of amongst the leadership there and also amongst the people, that Trump is favorable to Israel. And I think that's kind of weird because so many reasons. Of course, we know that he leaked their intel very recently to the Russians.
They were not thrilled about that.
Not thrilled about that, but I don't think they necessarily said anything other than mentioning...
Apparently they yelled at like U.S. officials in closed-door meetings.
Okay, well, there's that. But when you talk about Trump, there was no public sanction of Trump, obviously, and I don't think there would be. But, you know, Trump during this campaign had repeatedly said things like Israel needs to step up and pay for their own security, and indicated that he might want to scale back on like aid to them, including military aid. And then after his inauguration, he's committed all kinds of weird social gaffes, like, you know, oh, I don't know, not mentioning the Jews killed during the Holocaust Remembrance Day, and also disputing where the Western Wall is. I mean, what happened was Netanyahu had wanted to go to the Western Wall with Trump, and they said no, it's a private visit, and that the Western Wall is in the West Bank, which is like the weirdest, I mean, you've never heard that come out of any U.S. politician's mouth. And so he's going to go on his own. And that really riled up Israelis. But, you know, despite all that, the sense seems to be he's good for us because he's bad for Iran. And, you know, to me, that's kind of a really simplistic zero-sum game because it kind of doesn't add up. I mean, he's also good for Russia. Trump is very good for Russia, and Russia is good for Iran.
And like when Trump got to Israel, he said he just got back from the Middle East. He clearly has some geography problems.
Oh, he did say that, and there was some, when he said that, there's video footage. I can't remember who was in the room, but one of the gentlemen in the room like kind of rubbed his face and just had a very exasperated look on his face, like, what is even happening here? But you know, there's, other than the Iran thing, this is another interesting issue, is that a lot of key Israeli figures believes that Trump is really good for the status quo. Now, see, what's interesting is Trump has many times said that he is going to make like the best deal ever. Like, he's in real estate, he's going to make the best deal using his son-in-law, and he's going to solve this conflict, and Palestinians are going to get their own state, and Israel's going to have their own state, and he thinks it's a real estate issue, okay? But in Israel, for example, the education minister, Naftali Bennett, who is actually one of Netanyahu's competitors, actually declared Trump to be, quote, the most Zionist president in years, and boasted that the era of the Palestinian state is dead. Now, it's interesting that, you know, while Trump has been making all these promises, the reports are that, you know, for Netanyahu and most of Israeli political leadership, which is very much right wing right now, more so than apparently before in its history, their interest is to actually maintain the status quo. And you have elements in Trump's cabinet, including the new U.S. ambassador, David Friedman, and Jared Kushner. They've actually both funded a settlement, you know, called Bet El, and it's tied to an institution that advocates against Palestinian statehood and is pro-settlement. And the settlement issue is a major issue for Obama. So, you know, I think what's happening here is that Israelis are looking at Trump and saying he's making these promises, but we know he doesn't keep his promises, and he also doesn't, maybe other than just not keeping them in general, he also doesn't have the power to actually make anything happen.
He also doesn't care. More dangerous. He just doesn't, like, he has no internal preference or guiding principles. So he could change on a dime. Whatever's going to suit his whims tomorrow is what his position will be on Israel.
You know, basically, you know, given all these elements, I certainly don't see Palestinian statehood on any horizon. Although he did meet with the boss in Bethlehem, and, you know, but it was like, it was like Trump normal, very little substance in the visit. You know, it's all rhetoric, no policy details. He's like, we want peace, but there's no mention of settlements, of a peace process, of refugees, of statehood, nothing, nothing at all. And then we had, of course, we also can't have anything about connected to Trump that is not rife with weird things happening, like his wife swatting his hand. I mean, God, when I saw that, I don't know if my heart broke for her or not, but it was just, I just felt like it was well-deserved. Maybe if there's anybody who can put him in his place, it's Melania. You saw that video, right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's other videos from earlier where like she has tried to hold his, this is like going back to like early on in the administration when a couple times she tried to hold his hand, he swatted her away.
Oh, is that right?
Well, so, you know, I wondered if it was some kind of like, I mean, it's, you know, whatever. That's their thing, but.
That's their thing. They clearly are not a very affectionate. I mean, like there are rumors that they're, I mean, I don't know. There's rumors that they were considering divorce, but then the election happened. So who knows?
You know, apparently it was like some rule. You can't talk about their marriage because it's off limits. Because obviously no one's ever tried to talk about the Clintons' marriage or the Obamas' marriage.
Off limits there, how? From who? There's no rule.
No one's reporting on it. Like there's a lot of talk from like people in New York that like there was like a prenup made to keep Melania from like bailing and hurting his life. Although to be fair, I don't know why they thought that her bailing would like have hurt his.
Would make a difference. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. I'm like, are you kidding me? This guy has done everything in his power to be as repugnant as possible, and yeah. It did not deter his election. But you know, and there was what you mentioned also, the Yad Vashem visit that, you know, they have these memory books there. And when President Obama visited, he left this beautiful note about the tragedy of the place, the lessons of the place. And Trump, like, it was literally like it was the equivalent of like a thumbs up on paper.
It's so good to be here with all my friends. I'll never forget. Oh, no, it was like so amazing. And then after that, there's a little dash. It's like off center. Never forget.
I'll never forget. Yeah, it was just a real quick. It was embarrassing. But again, I think the guy's head is like totally empty. But then I thought this was like maybe the major gaffe, which is when he met Netanyahu in front of the press. He said, "I did not tell anybody. I did not say the word Israel to the Russians," thereby revealing that Israel was in fact the source of the intel leak. I mean, at this point, nobody officially had actually said that. I want to just insert the audio and let's listen to him as he completely opens up that can of worms.
Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had to know the story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
So Netanyahu did the stately thing and just kind of ignored the whole thing, pretended like this just did not happen. But
he did a very stately eye roll.
That was Israel. Then Trump moves on to the Vatican, and you know he had a 30-minute meeting with the Pope. It was kind of uneventful, other than I thought it was really interesting that every woman in the entourage, at least like I thought, pictures of at least four different women dressed in black with black veils, which maybe is a Catholic thing. I don't know.
I don't think it's a Catholic thing, but I do not know. It could be. I don't think it is, though. I'm not aware.
Another first lady or you know, or Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. I mean, I've never seen anybody else do that. So, but, you know, Melania is Catholic. So, you know, maybe this is part of her practice, but she got everybody else on board. And so I thought that was interesting, given the fact that especially these same ladies were in Saudi Arabia, ultra-conservative society, and they did not, like, they didn't change the way they dressed for that necessarily. You would expect the veil there, but that didn't happen. And instead, they had the veil at the Vatican. So good for them.
Well, I thought it was interesting, and I think it was a lesson for everyone who's working with Trump these days and who is trying to make the best of this administration, is that they didn't let Sean Spicer, devoted Catholic, go to the meeting. They had like Dan Scavino, like the social media troll, there instead. And this, you know, this is a lesson. Trump will not reward your loyalty. He will not do anything to acknowledge your sacrifices for him. He will humiliate you at every opportunity he gets. That's how he rolls. Like that's going to be a recurring pattern here. So,
well, it might also be an indication of what Trump plans to do with Spicer once he's back in town. I mean, like there is talk of Spicer being let go. But yeah, there have been reports that that Spicer was very upset that he is a devout Catholic. Although I don't know, can you be a devout Catholic and be like, you know, representing the spawn of Satan? I don't know how that works.
You can be a devout anything and do terrible things.
Seen
through all religions throughout the world.
That is true. Devout is relative, I suppose. And then the Pope gave Trump some books and messages on the environment and immigrants and peace, and clearly trying to, you know, wink, wink, send him a message. But, you know, not a lot happened. So what I thought was interesting was, to me, there was kind of a clear purpose to the visit of Saudi. I mean, there are actual things that, like, you know, initiatives that they wanted to kick off, and certainly Saudi interests were served. I didn't really so much see the purpose of the visit to Israel and the Vatican, other than, like, this, you know, okay.
Symbolism,
right? All three religious spaces. And also because he's kind of trying to look good to his base, which, you know, he does with the rallies too. It's like he's still campaigning. He just really wants to make his base, you know, not like him, I think.
He wants worship. He wants to be adored. And he thought that at least Israel and Saudi would give him that.
They did. He had very respectful receptions there in Saudi Arabia. You are not going to have protests, and you're not going to have the media asking you anything that's untoward.
And you get your face in every billboard.
Get your face in all the billboards. I actually think Saudi is the perfect place for somebody like him. I mean,
he wants to be like a Saudi leader. He would love to be a leader of like some undemocratic. Yeah.
You know, he wants love to that. Be a king.
He does not want to be a leader of a democratic nation. He wants to be adored like that.
Yeah. And, you know, in a society like that, which is, I mean, like, you know, you're talking about, or and he was surrounded by opulence. It was one of the most opulent receptions I've ever seen. And, you know, and completely devoid of women. So, and for Trump, I think he's okay with that too, because many of the meetings that we see coming out of the White House, the photographs look exactly the same. Yeah, I think he'd be very comfortable there. But the other thing is this, that I think it was kind of a good break for him in a way, for his ego, because he got to take a breather from the media in the United States, which he views as very hostile, and is, and rightly so. Well, he did have to go then to NATO, and he did go to NATO. So NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organizations, and for folks who might not know exactly the details of it, it's an alliance of 28 nations that are from Europe and North America. And it exists specifically to protect each other, right? Like, there's something called collective defense, and Article 5 of that basically says if one NATO ally is attacked, then all the NATO allies are attacked and they come to each other's defense. And this is the foundation of the alliance. NATO is incredibly important to national security of liberal democracies in Europe, the United States, of course, North America. It's vital in our U.S. military missions. NATO forces have fought alongside U.S. forces in basically almost everywhere we've been. They fight terrorism and cyber threats. But, you know, Trump has been pretty harsh about NATO, especially during his campaign. And repeatedly he brings up who bears the financial burden, which I think is incredibly an immature and unsophisticated view. But let's listen to a little bit.
Also a wrong. Just totally wrong.
Okay. Well, yeah, well, I would love to hear you explain us why. But let's first hear what Trump had to say about NATO on the campaign trail.
NATO is obsolete. It was 67 years, or it's over 60 years old. It is many countries, doesn't cover terrorism, okay? It covers the Soviet Union, which is no longer in existence. And NATO has to either be rejiggered, rechanged, you know, changed for the better. I'm not saying the other thing that's bad about NATO, we're paying too much. We're spending a tremendous billions and billions of dollars on NATO.
You say that's completely wrong. Now that there is some kind of that the U.S. is sharing like a greater financial burden, which is what Trump is alleging. Why is that?
Well, he doesn't even understand how it works. For apparently, when he was with Merkel in the White House, he like gave her a bill. He thinks this is the money that we're somehow owed, as opposed to a commitment for like the next 10 years, well, 2024, to increase defense spending from all NATO members. So there's no obligation right now of any sort for like this magical 2% number that Trump keeps harping on. It's a goal they're aiming for and are working towards.
And but, you know, from NATO's website, the contribution can look different. And you know, the website itself says that every NATO country contributes to the cost of running the alliance. By far, the biggest contribution comes from allies taking part in NATO-led missions and operations. So, for example, one country might provide fighter jets. I actually wonder if they drafted this after Trump. But while another provides ships or troops. And but you know, so Trump, but he's flip-flopped a bit about NATO after the inauguration. I can't remember at what press conference he said that, you know, he used to think NATO was irrelevant, but it's not irrelevant now.
Now that he's elected, it's not irrelevant. He fixed it. Just being elected, he fixed it. I mean, look, this is all Russia. There's no other reason Trump would care about NATO. Russia wants to destroy NATO. This is like Russia's ultimate goal in life. Trump is playing it. Like, really, why else would he care this much about NATO? Unless someone got into his ear and is like, you know, NATO's a bad deal for America. I think America should go out on its own more and force other countries to pay for them. Why are you paying for defense for Germany when Germany's competing with you with cars?
Right. I mean, and he has a, I don't know what the relationship between Russia and Germany is, but Trump is certainly creating a very hostile relationship. It's being reported in the German press that addressing Germany, Trump said something about Germans being bad and like some kind of evil history or something like that. So not doing well. We know Angela Merkel and him don't quite get along.
Putin's thrilled. If they can separate German and American interests, which they have, this investment has paid off more than they ever could have expected.
Right. I mean, look, undermining the U.S. commitment to NATO, and specifically, and this is what, you know, people were watching very carefully to see what his remarks at NATO would be like. And he did not do what is expected of every president, which is to recommit verbally, you know, our commitment to Article 5, which is a collective defense. And that it is the most important article of this agreement, which is an attack against one ally is considered an attack against all. And so by completely ignoring that and failing to mention it, you know, what folks are concerned about is that we are the largest military partner to NATO, right? So when you undermine this alliance, you're number one taking away from deterrence, right? You're emboldening people who could try and take advantage of a weakened alliance. And like you said, there's Russia. There's also China.
It's mostly Russia. They're not concerned that China's going to come over and invade. Russia actually might. They've done it before. They could again. And then right now, they're not even sure the U.S. is going to step up to defend them.
Right, right. And so, you know, the NATO visit, I think, can be quite consequential. And it's of concern. And I just don't know, from the administration front between Trump and Tillerson, I mean, that's kind of where the power lies on this issue, right? I mean, I would assume that
Tillerson has no power. Tillerson's not even included in big meetings. Neither is McMaster.
Well, you would think that, you know, on this issue, at least when it comes to NATO, I mean, it involves our military, that he would have people at the Pentagon and defense and national security advise him on this, because it really does undermine our own security as well. When, you know, maybe Trump feels like, you know, United States is not threatened. You know, we, whatever Russia does over there, it's not going to threaten us. But, you know, history has shown that when there is war in Europe, it does impact us and we do get involved, obviously.
Did you see the videos from the trip? The various ones where I had a hard time watching. I just cringed so hard.
You know, I just saw the one where he pushed other NATO members out of the way to be in the
front. The president of Montenegro, the country that just survived an attempted coup by Russia, he like literally pushes him out of the way so he can be first in line.
It's a really embarrassing video. I mean, and the thing is, you know, this is a man in his 70s. I wonder what kind of teenager and child he was, because
he once gave an interview where he said he basically stopped developing in first grade. Who he was then is who he is now.
What?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. No, he's totally right. It's probably like the most like self-awareness Trump's ever had.
Look, if my kid treated anybody like that as a child in first grade, did that to other kids, push them out of the way, oh, they would be held accountable. You'd not get away with that in my house. Yeah, no, I saw some of it. I also saw, I thought this was a really interesting clip, when NATO leaders were walking out and Macron from France, you know, was arriving, and he walked right up to the group. Trump was at the front of that group, but he ignored Trump. He went to Angela Merkel first. He shook hands with a number of other people, even though Trump was right there. He kind of did it purposely.
He didn't want to arm wrestle. Can you blame the guy?
Well, when Trump finally got the shake from him, you could tell he was trying to pull his arm out of the socket. Watch the video if you haven't seen the video.
I have. I can't watch it again.
All right. So that is a roundup of his trip. There's a lot happening while he's been gone. And when we get back next week, we're going to talk about all the things that have been taking place, including something very large on our radar, especially for me, I'm watching closely, is the new Trump's budget proposal, which is called A New Foundation for American Greatness. There have been hearings. They're holding hearings on it on Capitol Hill, and I've been listening to the hearings. And it's pretty alarming, and I think we should all be paying attention to this and also be in touch with our representatives. So we're going to go, I would like to go in depth on that next week, and I'm sure, Susan, I'm still keeping my fingers crossed for more Russia and maybe Kushner from you coming next week, so.
And I promise to bring the Russia.
Will you bring the Russia?
I'll bring the Russia.
All right, so we will we'll be back in a week.
Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled Patreon. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
Like my own family. So I don't get that stuff, and it's all political. And to say that
can
this
I,
is...
Can I interject with a little bit of a... A confession that actually horrified me about a week or 10 days ago. I found this out, and I'm actually going to totally out myself and my mother. My mother apparently voted for Trump. Okay.
My dad did.
Oh my God.
My dad voted for Paul Ryan.
Okay. Well, okay. Paul Ryan is still better. When I heard my mother vote for Trump, I did not know this. She never told anybody.